No other Sunday is like this Sunday in the church year. It's schizophrenic, Palm Sunday. One minute we're shouting Hosanna, and the next we're crying, crucify him, in 5 days. How do you move from one of those extremes to the other in such a short time? And to fully understand this, we need to look at what 1 Samuel says for our answer. Here's the scene. The elders of Israel demanded a king, so that it could be like all of the other nations around them. So Samuel, following God's direction, consents to their wishes. It is emphatically stated, nevertheless, that the Israelites are now rejecting God as their king, even though Samuel is being told to go do what they want. And the writer points out that having a king is a double-edged proposition. A king will, in fact, provide for Israel a centralized military organization, able to more efficiently deal with threats to her national security. A king would provide certain benefits, that's for sure, but would also take certain things. Take is the key word in verses 11 through 18 in 1 Samuel. A king is going to need a standing army. He's going to need a defense, and that's going to have to be paid for. That would involve conscription and taxation, a necessary expense. But above and beyond the functions a king would want, also pomp and ceremony and circumstance, and the best of all things that money could buy. After all, he's the king. And the king would need a forced labor pool to make this, to provide food for himself, his household, and his servants, and support for the royal court and for the armed forces, which eventually leads to Israel's downfall at the very end of Solomon's reign. As the saying goes, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But the worst feature in Israel's demand was the desire to be like everybody else. In the name of security, which is the same thing we do, Israel was committing the sin of idolatry, the sin of wanting to be the same as everybody else out there. But Israel was not the same as everybody else. Israel had been called into her future, fate, and security by the one living God who was invisible, thus making for them a visible witness by a slave people to the power and might of an invisible and loving deity. Egypt, the largest standing army in the world at the time. Israel, a slave nation, slave forced labor, are under Pharaoh's watch. And Jesus comes along and he says, I'm going to throw away all of the traditional expectations that you have of security by leaving my father's business as a carpenter to become a wandering itinerant preacher. With nowhere to lay my head in particular, I don't have a palace to lay down in. The birds of the air, well, they have nests, and the foxes, well, they have holes in the ground, but the Son of Man, not so much. Jesus, you see, had thrown away all of these traditional conceptions of personal safety by preaching a message that angered his theological contemporaries and challenged the supremacy of the Pharisaic laws that governed where he and his people lived by continually breaking those laws in the name of a higher law, the law of love in relation to self, neighbor, and God. Jesus, you see, had shown himself to be utterly indifferent to the verdict of his society and the expectations of everybody in it that had been passed down for thousands of generations. He had shown that the definition of kingship did not depend on what anybody else said it should be or what he should be. Thus, those who cheered him on as king on Palm Sunday when he came in came to betray him in 5 short days and cry, crucify him on Friday. And I think that this is true for all of us, because most of us, the voice and the expectations of our neighbors, those that we live around, is much louder than the voice of God. What will people say? What will people think are the first thoughts that pop into our mind? It's one of the first questions that we ask ourselves whenever we take a controversial stand. The Church of Christ still does not fully appreciate what Jesus meant when he said that his kingship was not of this world. But this is nothing new. We see it here happening in our text from Matthew's Gospel. Here you are. You're in Jerusalem. You're there to celebrate the biggest, the grandest holiday of the year. It's Passover, man. There's a million people packing in to Jerusalem at this time of year. The time, Passover, when God took you as a slave people out of bondage from the world's leading superpower, Egypt. Egypt, who had the largest standing army in the world at the time, an army that would be eventually utterly destroyed by God at the Battle of the Red Sea. You know the story. You've heard it your whole life. Every year at Passover, you tell the story. Your parents, your grandparents, your children, your children's children, they've heard it, all of them, generation upon generation. In fact, you don't know anybody in your entire family lineage that does not know this story. So when you come to remember on Palm Sunday in Jerusalem the mighty military acts of God that you've heard of, you also see this miracle worker, and he's coming into town, and he's been raising people from the dead, you've heard. You've heard him that he's restored sight to the blind. Literally, the guy can walk on water and turn water into the finest Merlot. And you can't help but believe that God is about to do to Rome as God had once done to Egypt when he comes into the city. That would be the normal expectation of everybody. For thousands of years, that would have been the normal expectation of everybody. So here you are along that parade route for the conquering hero that's going to at last come in that you've heard so much about. The vendors are lining the streets and side streets. They're passing out palm branches for you to wave as a sign of homage to this conquering king. Some of the folks are even laying down their coats and their garments. But you've just had your tunic dry cleaned, so you're not really deciding to do that. You said instead, I'm going to wave the palm branch, keep my jacket on, thank you very much. But it doesn't matter, does it? Because the atmosphere around you is charged with anticipation and celebration and a sense of victory around the corner. And after all, you might just be in for the biggest, biggest king that's ever arrived in Israel's history, bigger than King David. And you know who that is. He's the guy that slew the giant of all giants, Goliath. So we might literally excuse this crowd for failing to notice one significant small detail. This Messiah is coming into town on a donkey, not on a stallion, and on a colt, not even a mature donkey. Conquering kings, you see, rode into towns on stallions. Kings who came in peace rode on donkeys, but this isn't even a mature donkey, so what the heck does this mean? The king is coming in peace. That's what this message is being sent. The king is coming in peace, but he's also sending a signal to you, his followers, and to Rome, for that matter, at this moment. He's saying that his kingdom is not of this world, and he's not going to do unto Rome as Rome has been undoing to you. What? What are we getting so excited about then? And that's the rub, isn't it? He doesn't fit our expectations. We want life to be fair. I do. And I want a little payback from time to time. It's called justice for the way Rome has been treating us. Why should we continually endure this? They have us living near the poverty level because of the taxes that they're extorting out of us. I can barely make ends meet, and here comes the Roman governor saying I got to pay up again. They've crucified or terrorized somebody that you know. The streets outside of Jerusalem are lined with dead bodies testifying to the power of Rome's might for sedition and treason. They've desecrated the temple in Jerusalem more than once. They've put in the Roman soldiers. They've massacred worshipers here. It's our holiest shrine, and they have done it more than once to us. And then you realize, as this guy is coming in on this little donkey, that he isn't going to do what you want him to do. He's not going to be who you want him to be. He's not going to meet all of those expectations. So you get mad. I would get mad. Because he's fooled everybody. He's fooled all of us. And I'm getting mad, and so are the people around me, because we've been waiting for a Davidic king for a long time. And this guy is instead saying crazy things like, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. What? Why? And pretty soon, everybody is saying, there must be something wrong with this guy. In fact, he's probably possessed by a demonic spirit. After all, no one else talks and acts like him. Is he really on the side of Rome? I mean, it doesn't sound like he's going to do anything to Rome. How could anybody around me be this wrong? How could I be wrong about this? You know, it's not us, it's not me, it's Jesus who's been misleading all of us. He's responsible for my disappointment. He's responsible for my anger. Yeah, he knew what he was doing all along. He had 3 years. He could have clarified so many things, but he didn't. So let's show him. Let's kill him. I mean, if we only get one person that we get clemency for from Pilate, well then let's ask for clemency for Barabbas, right? Barabbas, after all, is a zealot who's been fighting against Rome for us. Why would we want to let this guy off the hook when we can have Barabbas back in the ranks? So when all of the profound words have been said over Holy Week, what is it all about? Am I to identify with the crowd on Palm Sunday, who one moment is cheering the arrival of Jesus without a clue as to what it means, as the long last liberator come to set us free from everything that has ever beset us? The one who's crying aloud that he has set the oppressed free, he has let the captives go, he is raising the dead. How am I to live with that when I don't see that being fulfilled? Maybe. You see, the meaning of Palm Sunday and Holy Week really boils down to being honest with ourselves. It's not about understanding what happened 2,000 years ago. It's about understanding what happens today. I know that there are times when I'm no different from that crowd gathering to cheer and to welcome Jesus, so to speak, into my life, only to turn and condemn him, because there are times when I condemn the very people that let me down and I love the most. You probably too. There's nothing like being betrayed by your closest family or friends, right? There's no pain quite like it. I know there are times when I run away from things, like you probably do, because they scare me and I don't want to deal with them. Just like the disciples, because it's more important to save my hide or to be liked by people than to take a stand for what I truly believe in from time to time. Those are the things that are like what it was like 2,000 years ago for us today. The older I get, the less I know. And the more I wonder, the more I ask questions, the less interested I am in intellectual insight, and more interested in the new life and the transformation that is promised to all who follow this man of mystery. Either he delivers on that or he doesn't. Either he conquers death or he doesn't. And if he doesn't do those things, then we, of all people, are the most to be pitied. I have more questions than I have answers at 60 years of age. But this much is certain: when I'm in the midst of an angry crowd that's going in one direction, I'm going to head in the other. I like how Kurt Vonnegut put it: trust a crowd to look at the wrong end of a miracle every time. Amen.